Blog Talk Radio.
In April 2004, my son Rowan was diagnosed with autism. The feeling was like being hit across the face with a baseball bat. Our lives became clogged under a mountain of conflicting information on the disorder. We tried everything. He didn't speak to us. One day, he ran away from me and ran right up to a horse called Betsy. The moment I put Rowan on Betsy's back, he began to speak.
He's a nice horse.
As Rowan began to open up to me for the first time, a light bulb went on in my head. Was there a place on Earth that combined healing with horses? Mongolia. This is a story about how, as a family, we did something crazy. How we ended up going halfway across the world in search of a miracle.
I think it wasn't exactly my vision of Mongolia.
We're going to go up a several thousand foot mountain and perform a 4-hour ritual with shamans. Isn't that what all families do? Sometimes I think he's like leaping forward, and sometimes it's like he's totally regressing. I couldn't help wondering, did I really have his best interest at heart here?
I don't know how useful it is to think of us as normal and Rowan as the sick one.
And then something happened. Rowan began laughing, giggling. We were together again as a family. We're onto something good here.
Welcome to Fire Talk Production. Our guest today is Rupert Isison. He was born in London to a South African mother and a Zimbabwe father. His first book was entitled The Healing Land, The Bushman and the Kalahari Desert. He is also the author of The Horse Boy, which tells the story of his and his wife's journey across Mongolia on horseback to find healing for their autistic son and for themselves as a family. He has traveled extensively in Africa, Asia, and North America, and now lives in Austin, Texas with his wife, Kristen, and their son, Rowan. In addition, he has just signed the contract for the follow-up to the book, The Horse Boy, The Long Ride Home, which tells the story of everything that has happened since Mongolia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Fire Talk Production. My name is Nell Cole, and I'm your host. Rupert, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What did you think when you listened to that trailer again? You've probably heard it so many times now.
Yeah, but it still affects me emotionally. You know, it really does. Partly because Rowan's doing so much better now, partly because I remember how it was, partly because the experience of going to Mongolia was just so incredible in so many ways. I can't listen to that and not react emotionally.
Oh, I bet. We're going to get deeper into that, but before we do, I want to go over some basic information so everybody can find you and have a better understanding. So can you tell us what autism is and how does it manifest itself in the behavior of children?
All right. Well, autism is a neuropsychiatric condition that usually results in the impairment of someone's ability to make social contact, to deal with the outside world. And so obviously outward symptoms of that could be lack of speech, extreme inwardness, and being very withdrawn, not appearing to understand what's going on around them, appearing to be all sort of on a different planet in a way. And then it often also goes with sensory issues in which the child is getting misinformation through their nervous system so that a breath of wind could feel like fire, or their clothes could suddenly feel like they weigh 10,000 pounds. And this causes them to have these enormous meltdowns and panic. And these sort of dysfunctional behaviors you'll often see. So it's a very difficult condition. But there's also, it's a spectrum. So it can go from people who have it in a very severe form, who are seemingly unreachable, to people who are sort of mad professors, who are, you know, incredibly intelligent and often quite successful, but seem to have poor social skills. It's a continuum as well, where somebody starts on the spectrum isn't necessarily where they finish up. So there's room for an awful lot of improvement over the years. But it's definitely something that's growing. 25 years ago, it was 2 children in 10,000. Now it's 1 child in 88 and 1 boy in 56. So it's becoming a pandemic. And that's why we're all interested in it, because it's reached a point where no one is untouched by it really anymore.
Now, why do you think it affects male children more?
We really don't know why it affects males. And here's another interesting thing. Female children who have it are often more severe than the male children, but more boys have it than girls. Now, we also don't know if the current pandemic in autism is true autism, or whether it's a reaction to increased toxicity in the environment, which results in autism-like symptoms. But what we do know is that the interventions that you'd use for regular autism do still work.
I always thought it was that. I always thought it was children who were born really sensitive to begin with, and they're just reacting to things that are a part of our everyday life, but we don't know exist, but their body recognizes it.
And 30 years ago, the world was not as toxic as it is now.
Right.
So, you know, there were people who were perhaps vulnerable to these toxins who were not showing up because they were not reacting to them in the same way. But now they are. And so we're seeing a lot more of it.
And now, when I was watching the documentary, I noticed the deeper you got into it, the better he got. And I was wondering if it wasn't that he was toxic. And as you journeyed, you ate different things, the air was cleaner. And I was wondering if some of it had to do with the fact that it just wasn't as polluted as where he normally is.
In Mongolia?
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, Mongolia, I think, is pretty polluted.
Oh, really?
It has an intact ecosystem, but Russia is right on the border, China is right on the border, and you have to remember that Mongolia itself is a post-Soviet society.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of this stuff that the Soviets got up to when they were there was not that great. So the winds that are blowing, you know, industrial stuff in the clouds over from China or over from Russia
could be as
full of toxins as anywhere else. But I do think that a change of environment is very important. And I think that's why Rowan was sort of in a good place from the outset, because there's no question that if you put these children in nature, they do exponentially better than if they're in urban or suburban environments. And this has been noted by almost everybody in the field now over the last few years, and that seems to be to do with their sensory issues, that the more they're in nature, the less those sensory buttons are being pushed, and the less they're in nature, the more those sensory buttons get pushed.
Wow. Can you tell us about your foundation and what all you do there?
Okay, so now I run something called the Horse Boy Foundation. There's a website, it's horseboyfoundation.org, horseboyfoundation.org. And what we do is we work with autism families free of charge in our area. And then we work around the world through satellite centers that we have trained specifically to do what we do with autism. And what we do is we work on a neuropsychiatric level, doing exactly what my son basically showed me worked for him. And then I tried it with other kids, and it worked with them too, so we kept doing it. And what we really do is we work through the idea of kinetic learning, learning through movement, in other words. That kids who are on the autism spectrum and kids who are ADD, ADHD, these things, they all seem to share something in common, which is that they're kinetic learners, that they must move in order to learn, and that if they're made to sit still, it's so stressful for them that they can learn one thing, and that's how to sit still. So you either move, there's two ways of approaching kinetic learning, and one should do both. The first one is you move with the child. So let's say, for example, you're both bouncing on a trampoline together or something. But the second type, and this is where the horses come in, is if the child is seated on a moving object, like a horse, that has a very rhythmic motion, then the child can find a certain physical stillness, and that opens up the learning receptors of the brain even more. And what we do is we move between those two poles, and we set up an environment specifically for autism where there's no sensory buttons like fluorescent strip lighting or industrial cleaning solvent smells and these things that now we know set a lot of autistic kids off. And then we work first on their sensory issues, then we work on riding with them in the same saddle as us, it's sort of exploring the exterior world. And we found that the more rhythmically we do that, the more they communicate. And that seems to have to do with the rocking of the hips that happens when a horse moves in rhythm. And that causes the rider's body to be flooded with a feel-good hormone called oxytocin. And then from there, we can teach perspective taking, academics, self-advocacy, everything. And we do it sort of over years. We work with the whole family. And that in a nutshell is horse boy method.
Now, have you ever seen any kind of chair or anything that mimics that motion that would help them
Yes.
when they're learning?
Yes, definitely. People sometimes say to us, listen, guys, it's all very well for you. You live in the countryside in Texas.
Right.
And you've got horses. You know, what about me? I live in an apartment building in New York. And it's a fair question. And yes, in fact, there are many ways you can use play equipment to mimic that kind of rocking motion. The key, though, is to sit behind the child.
Okay.
So that you are not a challenging frontal gaze that they have to defend themselves from. And then you are a voice in their ear. It's like you can insinuate yourself into their thought processes. You can also give them deep pressure by holding them, which a lot of them like, and rocking them. And this switches on the learning receptors of the brain. And you can do this on a teeter-totter. You can do this on a swing. You can do this on a surfboard. You can do this in a kayak. You can do this rocking together on the couch. But once you know that principle of kinetic learning, you can kind of do it anywhere. The horses optimize it, no doubt. And the horse also has a certain magic that he brings to the table.
Right.
But there are many ways to do this, even within any suburban living room. And then the more you do it outside, in a backyard, in a park, wherever, the better results you're going to get.
Wow. So you think it's best to sit with them behind them? Can you explain more about that?
Yeah.
Why?
So the autistic brain often develops a little differently to the what you call neurotypical brain, either normal, if you like, brain.
Yeah.
And one of the differences is that frequently the amygdala is overdeveloped, and the amygdala is the part of the brain that controls the fight-flight response, which is the production of another hormone called cortisol. Cortisol is what makes you produce adrenaline, so you can run away from the crocodile when it comes, you know,
right,
charging out of the reeds at you. It's quite healthy for the body to have little doses of cortisol and adrenaline every now and then, but it's really unhealthy for the body to have a constant slow drip of cortisol or stress. And this is why stress makes people sick, you know, if they have it over long periods of time. Kids on the autism spectrum, because their amygdalas are often overdeveloped, suffer from more anxiety than neurotypical kids do. And that's why they deal so badly with frustration and things like this. So when you are looking a child in the eye all the time, you trigger this fight-flight response in them. And they have two choices. They can either run away from you or they can go inside.
Right.
A lot of the kids just go inside. When you sit behind the child, you take all of that out of the equation.
Wow.
And suddenly the child doesn't have to defend themselves from you anymore. They can just absorb the information that's coming in.
Now, it can be toxic for a body to be flooded with that much adrenaline over a long, because these tantrums, wouldn't they create almost a toxic feeling for a child?
Oh yes, it can be a vicious cycle for sure. And a lot of people in the early days of autism, you know, the kids can tantrum, you know, most of the day.
Wow.
And the way that you try and start dealing with that, and this is what you pointed to in Mongolia in the natural environment, is there are some things that are known triggers for this sensory trauma. One of them is fluorescent strip lighting, which a lot of people on the spectrum see partly as a strobe effect.
Okay.
Another one is the smell of industrial cleaning solvents, those chemicals. Another one is loud industrial noise and echoey spaces. And then other kids have reactions to different physical sensations and so on. But if you take a kid out in nature into a place where they can take their shoes off and walk around on grass or sand or wood chips or small gravel, something that feels good under the feet. A lot of studies have been done on this now, and it seems that this really, really calms the nervous system down. And the easiest way to understand that is, what do we all do when we go to the beach? We kick off our shoes. And what, you know, what's that expression? You know, drinking toes in the sand, drink in my hand. You know, that's when we relax the most.
Yep.
You know, the reason is because sensorily it calms us down to take our shoes off and walk on those natural surfaces. And so you can do a lot of really simple things like that, which will up the kids' chances of being able to not be flooded by this fight-flight response all the time and actually be able to engage their intellect.
So a child throwing a tantrum all day also makes the parents' adrenaline go up. And therefore triggers the child more, I would think. So
yeah,
how important
sure.
is it for the parents' energy to be right?
Well, exactly. I mean, we all know that the more time we spend in nature, the more chilled out we are. So it's not just going to affect the kid to get them out into the park and out of the room. It's going to positively affect the adults that are dealing with it too. And the other thing is, you can't do this by yourself. And it's very, very hard because the vast majority of autism families are single mums.
Wow.
It's a sad fact, but fully 80% of autism marriages break up under the stresses. And usually it's the mum who's left with the kids. And it's very difficult for her because she's, you know, deprived of sleep and she's anxious and she's broke because the therapies are so expensive, and she feels guilty because maybe she's not able to give as much time and attention to her other children if she has them, and she's up to her elbows in poo because her kid's incontinent, and she gets told what a terrible mother she is every time she goes to the supermarket because her kid
right.
is out of control, and, you know, so there's a real vicious cycle there. And what one has to try and do, if possible, and this is something we look at with Horseboy Method, is we really try to provide an environment that you could say is tribal, where you have support from all sorts of chosen extended family, if you like, basically other autism parents and people who work in the field, who understand what's going on, who can exchange information, who aren't going to judge you, you know, who are in a position to actually offer practical help. And one of the things we try to train people who are interested in Horseboy Method in is how to create this kind of tribal environment so that the families and the mums, particularly who come, get a break from their stress.
Yes. I'm sure that's extremely important. I can't even imagine a a single mom with other children trying to deal with this, because it takes an enormous amount of time and energy and focus.
It does. Well, they are heroes, these moms. And, you know, a lot of them will be listening tonight, I'm sure. And I can just say this to all of you single moms out there and single dads who are coping like this. I just take my hat off to you, because I know what you're going through. And it ain't easy. It ain't easy. And you guys are the unsung heroes of our generation.
So let's go over a few more things before we get deeper into this. Now, you have a book and a DVD as well, correct?
Yes, I do. They're both called The Horse Boy, and they both tell the story about how we went to Mongolia and what happened there.
And they can be purchased on your website as well?
They can be, yes. You can get them from Amazon. You can get them off our website. I'd rather you got them off our website, because then the money goes up to help us serve kids. But you can also buy them at most bookstores. And you can watch the movie, the Horse Boy movie, on Netflix.
That's actually how I found you. Because I was just sitting around watching Netflix, and then I ran across your movie and started watching it. And then I looked you up.
Well, thank you for doing that. Anyone who's got Netflix can download it in 3 seconds, you know.
Now, do you accept donations as well?
Yes, we do. If people do want to donate, and we like it if they do, because remember, we don't charge the local families any money to come to us. If you go to our website, it's horseboyfoundation.org, horseboyfoundation.org, you'll see a big pink donate button. You just click on that, and it will take your credit card details. And we're a 501c3. We're a registered nonprofit. So you'll get a tax-deductible receipt sent email to you. But yes, please, if anyone does feel moved, every dollar, if you need just give $1, that's one day of hay for a horse, $1. So it really does help, even small amounts. So it's horseboyfoundation.org, and you'll see that big pink donate button, and then there's also a shop as well where you could buy the DVD or the book and then have the money go to the foundation rather than just to Amazon or whichever other great big corporation.
Yeah, definitely. And you have a follow-up book coming out?
Yes. We just signed the contract to write the sequel to The Horse Boy, which will be called The Long Ride Home. And it tells the stories of the three other healing journeys that we were told to make by the shamans that we met in Mongolia. It took us to Africa, to Australia,
really?
And then deep into the Navajo Reservation here in the USA, and what happened, and where Rowan is now. It's some pretty interesting stuff.
Now, and so you've been filming ever since Mongolia? You've been filming the Africa and the Navajo
yes,
and all that?
Yes, we have. We've kind of recorded the whole thing. And then also at the same time, parallel to that, we started the new trail center. That's where we work with the families directly. And then camps, which we've started all over the world. And we don't just do them with horses now. We also do them with surfing and all sorts of other things that we've found the kids really respond to. So, and Rowan himself is doing incredibly well and is starting his own web-based television series and about animals, because everything's about animals for him. It's called Endangerous, which is like a play on words of between both endangered and dangerous animals that are both endangered and dangerous. And we just got back from Romania in Eastern Europe, where he was filming European brown bears, which are both endangered and dangerous, in the forest behind Dracula's castle. So that gives you an idea of how well he's doing, and that's going to launch on the web this November.
Oh, good. I look forward to seeing that. So it sounds like he's doing really well.
He is. He is. I just got given, passed a note, though, however. We were talking about donations.
Yes.
You remember when you just got me before the interview started, you asked me where I was, and I told you I'm in a vet hospital. I'm actually
right.
calling from a vet hospital. So we had a slight emergency with one of our therapy horses who had an infected eye, and I've just been handed a note by Ileana, who's the woman I run the center with, and it turns out that his eye has been punctured by a thorn.
Oh, wow.
And we can either treat it or we can remove the eye. And the treatment might be more. We'll see what his chances are for him to see again from that eye. So if people do want to donate, if we treat this, it's going to be expensive. So if anybody does feel moved to donate, this could be $1,000 or more to get the horse treated properly.
Definitely keep me posted on what's going on with that, and I'll continue to put this information out.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. In fact, you've seen that horse if you've seen the movie, because at the very end, when Rowan is riding Betsy by himself, I'm riding a horse next to him with a white face. It's that horse with the white face.
How long have you had that horse?
About 8 years, 9 years.
Oh.
He's a very, very good therapy horse, so we need to treat him. I mean, obviously, we treat him anyway, but...
Definitely.
So, yes, if anybody wants to give donations, this could knock a bit of a hole in the foundation's finances.
Well, keep me posted, and I'll put
it out there,
and we'll see what we can do to help.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. That's such a hard decision. Many people with different types of animals face those decisions.
Oh, yeah. No, it is. And particularly if you work side by side with these animals all the time. I mean, these animals are really our colleagues. They're not pets. You know, they're really working animals that we rely upon with the children.
Oh, yeah. The magic that they work for children is incredible.
It really is.
Now, I want to move on to something that you said in the trailer that stuck in my mind, where you said we're going to go up to several thousand foot mountain and perform a ritual with shamans. Isn't that what all families do? And
yes.
When I heard that originally, I'm like, no, that's not what all families do.
Saying it with a sort of ironic twist.
I've got to, I want to understand your logic, because this is something I can't even think of another family who would do what you've done, and yet it worked. So I want to understand your logic and where
logic
it came from.
Got you. Logic is usually based on one's experience, right? So if we, you know, see that traffic is passing very fast on this road, then logically we assume that we must look before we step out onto this road because we might get knocked down by a car. You know, if you'd never seen a car before, it would never occur to you to look left or right. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So someone might say, well, why didn't that person look? Well, maybe they don't know what a car is. So shamanism is an interesting thing. We are not saying that shamanism cures autism. Autism cannot be cured. In fact, autism is a lifelong condition, nor should it be cured, because there's many people out there who are autistic who are leading amazing lives and productive lives and so on. There are many gifts associated with autism that I hope we'll get a chance to talk about later on. But remember, you introduced me saying that my family was from Africa.
Right.
So although we are white, I saw the first shamanic ritual in my life when I was about 7 years old on my grandfather's farm in central Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather was pretty racist, and he just said, oh, that's what the black people do, you know. But I also noticed that my grandfather did not give these people, these workers, any kind of clinic. And so they appeared to get sick and get better using this means of, some people would call it faith healing, some people would call it trance healing, some people would call it the laying on of hands, some people would call it prayer, some people call it, you know, witch doctory. But whatever word they want to give to it, in fact, shamanism is probably the most effective word. They got sick and they got better. And this is, in fact, the experience of many people around the world. Now, if I hadn't been exposed to that, then I would think, oh, my gosh, well, that's such a woo-woo idea, blah, 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 blah. But I would been seeing that sort of thing since I was a small boy. However, I didn't have any direct contact with it until my journalism. I'm a journalist. So I haven't got a woo-woo or a New Age bone in my body. I still write for all the hard-nosed British newspapers and magazines like the Daily Telegraph and the Times and people like that. And they won't publish woo-woo stories. You know? but I did get drawn into helping a group of Bushmen hunter-gatherers in southern Africa to win back their ancestral lands. And I, in fact, run another small non-profit that helps them do this. And these people do everything in their lives sort of through consultation with shamans and so on. And it's very practical for them. Not only does it work for their health, but it also works for their political dilemmas and so on. And they won the largest land claim in African history, you know, right under my eyes.
Wow.
Consulting with their shamans all the time about how they should brief their lawyers. So
really?
For these people, it's a very practical thing because it's part of their life day in, day out. You know, also, these people, if they have access to Western medicine, they'll use it in a heartbeat because it's easier. but not all things are so well addressed by Western medicine and not all things are so well addressed by shamanism. So they're practical people who are all about survival. So by the time my son was diagnosed, here's what happened. In 2004, which was the year he was diagnosed, I had to bring a delegation of Bushmen hunter-gatherers to the United Nations and the U.S. State Department because it was part of this land rights battle that was going on. Some of the guys who were on that delegation were trained healers in their culture. They met Rowan. They did some work with him. And Rowan, to my astonishment, began to lose some of his more obsessive behaviors. And although he fell back into the depths of those symptoms when these guys went back to Africa, I couldn't help but think, okay, he's had this radical and positive reaction to the horse, radical and positive reaction to these shamans. I am also, at the same time, you must remember, doing all kinds of normal orthodox therapies with middling results.
Right.
So logically, based on my experience, it seemed to me, and I had this intuition as well, I need to take him to a place that combines this kind of healing with riding. Is that Africa? No, because that's not a horse culture. Where is that place? That's Mongolia. That's where the horse comes from. They've still got a very strong system of shamanism there. And I had this absolute gut feeling that if we went there and rode horseback from healer to healer, we would get a result. I wasn't sure what, but that we would get a result. And in fact, we did.
And you were willing to get any kind of result, I mean, to build upon. So it's not like you thought he was going to be healed 100%. You were just
looking for
tools.
I'm much more practical than that. You know, but one of the things about being practical is you also have to understand, I think, in life, and we all know this, that
Right. Only
50% of life is rational. Only 50% of life can be explained through logic and so on. And in Western culture, we like to kid ourselves that we are very, very logical and we make all our decisions based on hard science and hard evidence, and we don't at all. We make most of our decisions, including our political decisions, based entirely upon emotional responses.
Yeah.
And this has been measured time and time again. And often this seems to be what works. Very well for people. You know, everyone has the experience of love, for example. We can't explain it. We can't define it. We can't say what it is. But we know it when we feel it. And we make a lot of our decisions based upon whether we're in love or whether we might love somebody or whether we've fallen out of love with somebody or whether we love a family member or we don't love this person. Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, but you could also argue that that's logical. You know, so there's an interesting dance between logic and the intellect and the non-rational and the intuitive. Also, for me, growing up, you know, I did a lot of hunting growing up. I hunted a lot. You know, African childhood, English childhood too, in the countryside. And when you hunt, you have to be able to put yourself in the place of the animal to anticipate what the animal might do. And that's not an entirely rational process. There's a point at which you come out of yourself. And if you don't know how to do that, you're not going to hunt successfully. And anyone who hunts knows that. Similarly with animal training, with horses and so on. You can't be operating from this completely logical standpoint because horses don't operate through logic. And so you have to be able to transcend, if you like, the barriers between species. And I think it's like this with autism too. You know, there's a lot of apparent barriers between autistic people, non-autistic people. And so what it comes down to is empathy, you know, empathy and the empathetic response. And I think that is ultimately the thing which decides whether something is effective or not. And what is empathy if not love, you know? So that's really what was guiding us in Mongolia was gut instinct, but based on personal experience, but both of my own in my childhood and what I'd seen happen to Rowan with these other healers. So in a weird way, it was logical to do this very illogical thing.
And to
not be attached to an outcome in a weird way.
Yeah, there's many things in my life that I see, and my logic is completely different than most people. But I have to just trust what I'm doing and just go with it, and most of the time it works out for the best.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I see you did. You weren't sure.
Exactly. And you've also got to be prepared to be wrong, you know, and for that to be okay. Because you may be flabbergasted to hear this, but I'm often quite wrong. being wrong is part of one's experience. But also, is it being wrong or is it just being part of the learning curve where you're gathering information over a certain amount of time? So that you might sometimes think, oh, that was a terrible decision that I made there. And then a year later you go, oh, yeah, but that bad decision actually led me to this other thing here, which da-da-da-da-da, and then I learned because of this. And actually now this is knowledge that I draw upon, so this is really valuable to me. So was it the wrong decision, or was it a necessary part of the learning curve? Like, is a baby wrong when they're toddling and they fall over? Are they wrong every time they fall over? Or are they actually on the right track because eventually they're going to walk, you know? And I think that that's more the truth of what we consider. But it's easy in the short term to say, oh, that was wrong, you know, because it didn't work out in that 10 minutes. But I think if one's looking for things to work out in 10 minutes, then one's going to have one's heart continually broken because God doesn't work in that way, you know, however frustrating that might be. We all know that things seem to work out on a much longer term thing, which is why short term, you know, things when they happen quickly appear so miraculous because it's so unusual. But it does happen too, like that sometimes.
Sometimes the negative experiences drive us even more, so they're more valuable. The times you fell on your face, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to understand is what formed your history of good and bad to where it came to you that this is what I need to do. And it's just a combination of life events, it sounds like, that made this seem like worth taking a chance.
Yeah, or more like that. Like, I have no choice. This is the obvious thing to do. I must do this rather than, oh, I could do this. Shall I do this? Shall I not do that? You know, when you get that absolute gut feeling, then one tends to be unwise if one doesn't act upon it. And again, I think the experience of falling in love is something which everyone experiences and which is very close to that, where you don't have any kind of, you don't think, oh, should I fall in love with this person or not? You know what I mean? It's like you either do or you don't, you know, and if you do, you sure know it.
Well, also what you and your wife were experiencing at the time required some kind of resolution just because it was so hard to live.
Yes, exactly.
That it does make you willing to try things that ordinarily you probably wouldn't even think about. But
Exactly, exactly. Desperate times call for desperate measures, I guess, yeah.
And now, I understand you had this thought in your mind, but what did you think would happen when you mentioned it to your wife?
I thought she'd tell me it was a terrible idea, and I was dead right. And you got to understand, too, that my wife, even though she's a product, she's not like me. You know, she didn't grow up in Africa and on farms in England and hunting and all that. You know, she grew up in the suburbs of Los Angeles. But she also had a hippie dad who lived on a hippie commune out in Hawaii, and she would go and spend summers with him sometimes. And they lived pretty wild. They lived in tents, and, you know, and so she experienced some more close to nature, less stratified kind of life. And when I met her, I didn't meet her in America or England. I met her in India. She was doing the research for her PhD. She's now a professor of psychology at the University of Texas. And I was writing a guidebook for a guidebook company there. And so she was already out there doing some quite adventurous stuff. And she'd lived abroad in other countries before. And, you know, and very quickly after meeting her, she was joining me on treks up into the rainforest, you know, to stay with remote tribes and things like this. So she's an adventurous girl. But at the same time, she will also always say, yeah, but I'm a reluctant adventurer, you know. Her first reaction is always like, no, it's a terrible idea. And then she's like, well, actually, maybe that would be quite interesting. However, she did make a very salient point, which was that she said, Rupert, you know, our lives are already very stressful. And you're telling me that if we somehow take our incontinent tantruming kid, you know, that this will make our lives less stressful, I don't believe you. No, I think it's going to make them a lot more stressful. And all I could say to her was, you know what, you're right. You're dead right. In the short term, I bet you it will be a very stressful trip. And I'll do my best to plan it properly and go about it the right way. And luckily, you know, I have experience in planning expeditions. I've done it, you know, before. But at the same time, you've got me, absolutely. But in a weird way, our lives are so stressful, as you say, that just going to the supermarket is so stressful, that in a way,
right,
we might as well go across Mongolia.
What difference does it make?
It's not like it's any less stressful.
Yeah. At least you're stressed and heading toward a resolution as opposed to just stressed.
Totally. And at least the autism is then leading us into an adventure, and a very beautiful adventure, rather than shutting our lives down. And I felt that was important, that here is something amazing that we can do because of Rowan's autism, not in spite of Rowan's autism.
Right.
And, you know, also, you don't have to come. You know, I said, you know, if you really don't fancy it, don't. You know, it's fine. I will go with a group of trusted friends who I know are good in those kinds of situations, and we'll be all right, you know, and we'll come back in a few weeks, and you're off the hook. You don't have to do this. I do understand that this is my gig, and I think it was important for Kristen to be let off the hook, and
yeah.
Then after a while she sort of went, well, actually kind of sounds quite cool. All right. But what she said was, it was quite funny. She said, actually, for me, it's win-win, because if it all goes wrong, I can say I told you so forever. And if something great happens, well, then great.
That's true. That's a wife for you.
Yeah, well, you know.
Well, you must be one hell of a salesman. Because you have friends that you could actually talk to go as well.
Well, you know, this is my world, really. And so, yeah, I know a lot of people who are similar to me, who've led a fairly adventurous life, and who for whom a trip like this would not seem so abnormal. And those are the people who you want to be with on a trip like that, you know, because you don't want someone who's going to panic, you know.
Oh yeah.
In a situation that doesn't warrant it, you want someone who's gonna. You also want someone who's going to enjoy it, you know. He's going to really enjoy, because kids always enjoy these types of trips. That's the thing. Humans are nomadic by nature. And we're not supposed to move all the time, but about once every 3 months in our natural state, we pick up and we move to a different area where there's a different seasonal food. And we usually, hunting and gathering tribes, and it's not so long ago that we were all hunters and gatherers, they tend to move between these six locations every season. And that's a very natural thing for kids to do. As long as they've got their people with them. So if they're traveling with their people and they know everything's cool, then they get into the adventure, they get into the newness, they get into the exploration and the wonder.
Yeah, it's, your story is amazing, and I'm sure that I can't even begin to understand the friendships and networks you have, because someone who's traveled as much as you, there's endless networks of people that you're connected to. That
yeah,
write a book about that probably.
Well, there is. I guess that comes back to the idea of tribe, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, having that community of people around you. That you share a culture, you're seeing through the same eyes, and that's important.
Are people drawn to you to be around?
Are people
you?
Drawn to me?
Yeah.
Well, it depends if I've watched or not. You know, if I forget to watch, yeah.
No, that's
like if you were standing next to me now, I've been out with the horses in the hot sun all day. I don't think so now. Flies would be drawn to me now. People probably pay me to stay on the other side of the yard. I don't know the answer to that question. I think maybe the truth is that people who have passionate interests
mm-hmm.
tend to be drawn to other people that have passionate interests. Because you share that passion, right? Whether it's horses or music or
right.
healing or travel or whatever it is. And so you tend to be, I don't know if people are drawn to people, but maybe I'm drawn to people. Maybe I'm drawn because I'm so curious and, you know, it might be more the other way around that I'm drawn to them. And they're just wishing I would go away and stop being so bored.
Go away already. That's funny.
That's right.
So I want to go back to talking about the parents again. What can they do to maintain their identity while dealing with this? Because I would think it would assume a large portion of people's life.
Because there's also this problem with isolation, that even though it's a pandemic, because, you know, it's hard to be told what a bad parent you are when you go to the supermarket and have people give you dirty looks and things. So there is a bit of an isolating effect. But one of the best things that Kristen and I did, because we could not have babysitters when Rowan was at his most severe, because, yes, although I do have these networks of friends all over the world, interestingly, here in Austin, none of our immediate friends could really cope with Rowan. And none of them
right.
really were at the stage where they were having kids and they couldn't deal with it. And, you know, and so we couldn't have babysitters, and we were starting to go a little nuts. And what we did is we realized that we had to start putting less pressure on each other, not more pressure on each other, at this critical moment. And so what we decided to do was say, we will be each other's babysitters. You go out. Each one of us gets one dedicated day a week, evening a week, where we go out, and the other one will stay home and look after the kid. And only be moderately passive aggressive when the other one comes in. Because the whole idea is, and don't even come back. Don't even come back tonight. Go crash with friends. You know, go out, have a few drinks, do whatever you want to do. But come back fresh,
yeah.
and with your batteries recharged, so that you can pick the thing back up and do your stint tomorrow. And that was a really good practical decision that we made, and it welded us and it made us part of the same team, rather than starting to pick each other to pieces, because we were starting to do that, and that's very natural when two people are suffering together, that the only person who understands the suffering is the person who's going doing it alongside you, and sometimes you can turn on each other a little bit.
Right.
Despite the best will in the world, that can happen. So that really prevented that from happening, and I would definitely recommend that, is if you can broker that deal as a partnership and say, you know, you get Wednesdays and I'll take Fridays, it's going to work a whole lot better.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of
very,
people.
Very, very hard, but it's very, very hard if you're a single parent.
Yes.
Very hard if you're a single parent. And then I guess one has to try to find somebody who can step in that way. And that's not always easy. That's not always easy at all.
No, it definitely sounds like it's an extremely stressful life. But you spoke earlier about gifts that children of autism have. Can you expand more on that?
Yeah, I think there's many gifts that autistic people have. Firstly, unless there's some associated condition like mental retardation or grand mal seizures or something like that, most people on the autism spectrum seem to actually have an above average intelligence.
Right.
But it goes beyond that. They also have near photographic memories, and because they're not concerned with social stuff like, you know, am I one of the cool kids? Or they're much, much better at getting on with the job. So that later on in life, they tend to be very, very productive. But there's another thing, too, which I think transcends this stuff, which is that people on the spectrum are almost without ego. It's very interesting. We don't really know why. It's something to do with a different brain development. But it's a total gift. So someone like me, you or me, you know, we have neurotypical minds, which means that our egos are the things that give us the most pain and suffering in our lives. And am I rich enough, thin enough, this enough, that enough, you know?
Right.
Constantly comparing yourself to someone. Oh, that person's a better parent than me. That person's more successful in their career than me. Oh, that person's better looking than me. That person, you know, doesn't behave so badly when they're drunk like I do, you know. And you're constantly beating yourself up. And then the moments where you feel okay about stuff are moments, and then you sort of go back on, you're always on this roller coaster. Kids on the spectrum seem to have something which Buddhists call the quiet ego, where people like you or I can achieve that if we were to spend some decades, in really quite rigorous spiritual pursuit. But a lot of kids on the spectrum are born this way, and which means that they're very healing for we neurotypical normal people to be around, because they don't press our mirror neurons in our brain, so that we don't get our ego buttons pressed, basically, when we're around them. So we kind of weirdly get a break from our own egos and our psychological angst when we're around these people. And so you could almost argue that because it's such a therapeutic effect, you know, should we be paying autistic people $100 an hour, you know, to be around us because it's so therapeutic? Perhaps, you know, perhaps we should. It's an interesting question, but there's many, many gifts associated with autism.
Well, I guess that what you see is also based on who you are when you're looking. What you perceive as a gift, some people may not perceive, or may not be in a place where they're able to view that as a gift. So.
I guess that's true, yeah. But that's life, isn't it? You know, one man's talks, another man's poison, you know.
But I love the way that you did everything that you could to get into his world. And that's something that I see a lot of people want, to bring that child to act more normal, for lack of a better word. And they're always trying to monitor their behavior to say, you need to feel more, you need to this more, 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 more. And I can understand why a child would check out, because they're tired of people demanding stuff that they don't even comprehend what they're talking about. So how do you change your logic? And like I say, where people want children to love them and express love and express, how do you help a person change their mindset on seeing things differently? Does that make sense?
It does. Well, the first thing I think is to start being aware of those gifts. And so, for example, at the New Trail Center where we work, there are several adult autistic people who work with us who are now, very functional, and but were not always so functional when they were young. And they can explain to autism parents from the inside what it's like and what the kids go through and what the kids thinking and feeling, and translate if you like, for the parent. And that's immensely useful. And then that helps the parent get, so they don't have to take my word for it, because, you know, what do I know? I'm an autism dad, but I'm still not autistic. But these people are actually autistic. And so what
right.
they tell you is worth hearing. And so we can change the perception that way and really allow people to become curious about autism and friendly towards autism and to see how cool autism is and how amazing the minds of these people. And how it can actually increase your own quality of life to be around these people. And then once people get through the first initial fear and confusion, then again it comes down to tribe, doesn't it, of having the support of other people around who know the school, have been through it, because they, you know, really actually this can be very cool if you let it be. But at the same time, we totally understand and get why you're anxious in this moment, but take it from us, you know, don't worry, it's going to be all right. And here's why it's cool. And now let's go talk to Cisco, who is autistic, and he's going to tell you, you know, what your kid's doing at this point. Why is your kid doing this? You say, well, I used to do this, and this is why. Blah, blah. And then that works on a very practical level for people. The difficulty is if one is always dealing with professionals who are not autistic, and not even autism parents. In a weird way,
right.
their knowledge is very limited. And we don't need to make autistic people not autistic. What we need to do is give them survival skills, for sure,
yeah.
and help them to learn useful tricks like how to talk to somebody and, you know, how to swim and pretend and act normal in a way. But what we don't want to do is say to them, you're a problem, autism is a problem, you shouldn't be autistic. No, quite the opposite. What in fact we need to be saying is, this is really cool, thank you for letting me hang out with you, because this is really cool. Now,
wow.
in this weird world of humanity, there are people who will be mean to you or whatever if you don't dance the dance like this. And the reason is fear and blah, 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 blah. So we have to learn to dance a dance like this. But it's only a dance. It's just a dance. It's just like learning another language. But you are perfectly cool as you are. And more than that, I want to know more about who you are, because I'm fascinated, I'm intrigued, and I think you're amazing. And if you take that approach, then I think people can learn skills very easily. Oh, yeah, okay, I'll learn to keep my pants on, you know, okay, I'll learn not to
yeah.
jump around and scream in the supermarket, you know. And at the same time, you're showing genuine interest, you know.
Yeah.
Tell me more about this. I am interested because it's so fascinating. And then you're dealing with autistic people as peers and equals, not as people with some deficit. And also more than that, as people who can have something to teach you.
Wow. And that's a completely different energy that you put out when you come with that kind of logic, as opposed to you're broken and society's not going to accept you and you're a burden.
Yeah.
Because if they're
exactly.
that sensitive of energy, then they will know what you're really thinking, no matter what your
totally.
Words say.
Okay, kids aren't stupid. They always know, you know. And here's an interesting thing. I mean, in indigenous settings, tribal settings, like the Bushmen or in Mongolia, no one can be institutionalized. There are no institutions to send people to. And those societies are super practical. They're all about survival. Yet the people that are their healers, almost, and their shamans, almost all of them exhibit neuropsychiatric symptoms, whether
yep.
adult autism, epilepsy, bipolar, etc., to schizophrenia, to the point that they would probably be institutionalized if they lived in our culture. Yet in their culture, which is much more practical, much more survival-based, they have wives, families, are fully integrated, and their condition, this is really important, listen to me here, their condition is looked upon as a qualification for a job.
Yeah.
A qualification for a job. That's very practical, not a disqualification from society, because these societies cannot afford to waste human resources. If somebody can do something, they do it. So they find roles that work. You can, whether you believe, belief is a funny word, that the roles that they find for these people are effective or not. Well, we go back to that thing of people get sick and get better under their care. So,
right.
And if there was nothing in it, then they'd all be dead, because most of these people don't have access to Western medicine. So if it was all completely frou-frou, they'd all die, wouldn't they? But they don't.
And it's not
just a sort of law of averages. If you get bitten by a black mamba or you get a certain type of cancer or something, you know, it will take you out unless someone knows what they're doing. Yet you see people, you know, come back from these things under this kind of palliative care. So we can do the same thing. I mean, I think it's up to us to find where are the roles for us. And indeed, I'm talking to you on a cell phone, which has all sorts of software in it. A lot of that software is developed by high-functioning autistic people in Silicon Valley, what people would call on the Asperger's spectrum. And
oh, wow.
I also know people who are nonverbal, for example, who publish books on poetry and things like that. You know, the skill sets here are way greater than we might think. And that it's a sign of a very affluent society, a society that can waste human resources and say, oh, we can put you in an institution. You can't institutionalize one in 88 people, you can't institutionalize one boy in 56. The entire economy would bankrupt itself if we tried to do that. It would be immensely impractical. So whether we want to find roles for these people or not, we are going to, because things change through economics. They don't change because people think it's a good idea or it might be nice or, you know, more ethical. Things change for the better because suddenly it becomes economically imperative for them to do that. For example, we founded the United Nations and the European Union as a result of World War II, you know, where we destroyed everything. We destroyed everything. It's hard for listeners in America maybe to really take that to heart, but I grew up, you know, in London playing on bomb sites. The skyline of the financial district as we know it in London was not there when I was a kid. There were huge empty spaces where there were like 1,000 9/11s, you know, ground zeros, right, everywhere. And unexploded ordnance lying around, and, you know, we destroyed ourselves. And there was, after 10,000 years of continual, you know, tribal war, which culminated in World War II, we kind of went, you know, it's not a really good idea, is it? We better do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And we better find a way to fight our battles economically. So we did it.
Right.
Because push came to shove, we had to. And I think that's what's going to happen here. When you've got such a vast chunk of the population in this position, it's going to radically affect the workforce, which means it's going to radically affect how business is done, and so on and so on. And it's very interesting. If there's all these people in the workforce walking around without egos, well, isn't that an interesting idea?
Yeah, that is.
And if indeed... And this is where it gets quite exciting for me. If indeed what we're looking at is a reaction to toxicity within the environment resulting in autism-like symptoms, well, that change in the environment, that negative change in the environment has happened largely because of the rampant human ego, the pursuit of wealth and power. And then you suddenly get, because of that, a whole bunch of people born sort of damaged by that who don't have this ego, who then, to some degree, shift the species to a more functional species that doesn't go around and shit in its own, you know, drinking water. Because it's not constant, they're not constantly taken up with, am I rich enough, thin enough, powerful enough, can I exert my power over you, my ego over you? And suddenly we move to a different type of Homo sapiens sapiens. And that's what the question I'm often asking myself is that what we're looking at here, some kind of accelerated development of our species into a better version of ourselves that's come as a direct result of the mistakes we've made? Isn't that interesting? And it's a possibility.
Wow. So they could actually end up being what saves us from ourselves.
They could be what saves the planet, for sure.
Yes, just by the sheer number of them alone. And the lack of ego and the sensitivity to the environment itself could generate protection of the environment
mm-hmm.
because of it. Wow.
Yep. Because the planet will happily go on whether humans are on it or not, you know. I mean, we can destroy ourselves and we can destroy life as we know it, but the planet will go on, you know. But we would quite like to stay here and enjoy it. And this could be, you know, is it possible anyway that this could be our ticket home, perhaps?
It could very well be. Now, your mind must go a million miles an hour because you are just, like, so intelligent on so many different levels.
See me after three beers and you will completely reverse that decision.
Well, at two beers, you're very intelligent. Three, we'll have to do another show on that and do a test. You'll be babbling before the end of it. One thing I do want to ask you is, how does a person who hasn't been exposed to autistic child approach that child? What's the best way to interact to not trigger them?
With gentleness and curiosity. Imagine you're approaching a young horse. Do you walk up to a young horse? Because a young horse is governed by its amygdala, by its flight response, right? And it solves its problems by running away because it's afraid that this large ape standing on two legs is going to eat him. Because, in fact, we have spent hundreds of thousands of years eating horses and only about 10,000 years riding them.
Right.
And every horse is born wild. Every cow is born wild. So you don't just walk up to a young horse and try and touch its head. And if you do, you stand a fairly good chance of being knocked over, run away, you know, stomped on or whatever, because he weighs 1,500 pounds. And if he feels he needs to get out of there because he spooked him, he'll go right over the top of you.
Yeah.
If you approach an autistic person as gently as you would a young horse, you let them come to you. You let them get curious about you, and you let them become comfortable with you. And you meet them more than halfway. Then the rewards are going to be very great. And the main thing, really, honestly, is just to flat out simply be interested. Like, this is cool. Show me who you are. I'm interested. Find out what interests them. Find out what motivates them. You know, if they have an obsessive, it's a child with an obsessive interest in Thomas the Tank Engine. Learn about Thomas the Tank Engine.
Right.
Learn to speak the language of Thomas the Tank Engine. And start from there. And then Thomas the Tank Engine can be a gateway to anything. You could go anywhere from there, couldn't you? You could go to math, physics, geography, locomotion, the Industrial Revolution, anywhere through Thomas the Tank Engine. So find out what motivates that child.
Right.
Cultivate a curiosity in it, and then meet the child on that ground, and they'll almost certainly reward you.
Oh, it sounds like, and I think your greatest gift is that you actually see the person who's in front of you and value that, no matter who they are or where they come from. There's an excitement within you to know more about people, and that's a really cool way to approach this world.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that I was brought up perhaps at a crossroads of cultures, you know, colonial Africans living in England. Not all my family's white. Not all my family speaks English. And that was a bit uncomfortable for me as a kid.
Yeah.
People were like, well, where do you come from? What are you? Who are you? And you're like, well, I don't know, really. You know, I'm sort of a bit of this and a bit of that. And then after a while, you realize, well, I'm all these things. And actually, that's quite interesting. That's a place of power, isn't it? Hybrid vigor and all that.
Yeah.
And the ability, you have to end up seeing things from a bunch of different points of view because for different points of view being presented to you all the time, and that's just that's just the reality, the practical reality of the situation is you have to survive. But again, you go back down to things like hunting and being out in nature and doing that stuff. You have to be constantly awake and watching for signs and what to do next, and to abandon this plan and move to plan B, and then abandon plan B and move to plan D, and all the time. To be that flexible, or it's just not going to work. You're just not going to get that deer, you know. So, I think curiosity is really the key here. That if one resists, we don't always want to learn the things that are in front of us. Goodness knows,
right.
I don't. You know, I'm as lazy as the next man, and you know, sometimes I just want to relax and watch Game of Thrones. I don't want to think about, you know, is autism mind the same? But then it then there'll be that little voice going, yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it? And you're like, all right, it is interesting, okay. But can I finish watching Game of Thrones right now? And then get to it. To answer, yes, absolutely. So you can relax sometimes too. One doesn't have to be constantly, you know, on the go.
Oh yeah.
But you know, but it's just that thing of being tickled by the difference and intrigued by it rather than threatened by it or upset by it. And if you are upset by it, forgive yourself. Say, okay, that's just a natural human reaction. But I also know that's just me being a bit of a puss, you know. And, you know, when I get over being such a, you know, a little boy about this, which I will, then I can move to the next phase, you know. Because I'm only three, you know. And most of us are only three, you know.
So
I don't know, I'm regretting. I used to be three. I'm closer to two right now.
Tell me what it's like living in Texas with your mindset, because I have relatives from Texas, and sometimes it can, I would think they would be very curious about you.
Well, Texans themselves are pretty curious, they just don't know it, because Texas is such a big place that you can drive for a million days and you're still in Texas, you
mm-hmm.
know, so, but to the rest of the world, Texas is like a pretty exotic type of place. And curious, but actually, where I live is I live near Austin. I live out in the country, but I live near Austin, and Austin is kind of hippie central.
Yeah.
Everyone who's sort of grown up within the sort of Southern Baptist hell of wider Texas and has escaped it ends up in Austin, and
yeah.
So Austin is one of the original cities of the counterculture because it had something very reactionary to react against. But you're talking to someone who grew up partly in apartheid South Africa and Zimbabwe. I have seen redneck in a way that you can't even imagine. Well, you probably could if you could think about the South circa 1850. I've seen it like that.
Wow.
And I've seen people, you know, losing their lives over it. So to me, you know, a lot of Texas is pretty conservative and people can be quite bigoted and there's a lot of hate. In the way that people deal with each other, for sure.
Right.
But at the same time, a lot of Texans are really, really cool. And you don't necessarily know, you know, political differences and things like that don't necessarily dictate it. And that's why Austin is an interesting place, because I do think one of the great afflictions of the USA right now is this absolute polarity and polarization between are you conservative or are you liberal? You know, and it's like high school, and it doesn't get anyone anywhere. And the people are actually not that different from each other at all. If you've lived in places that have had civil wars and things like that,
yeah.
It's like, you guys are actually not that different. You know?
Yeah, that's
not. You know,
that,
and there's
the worst
thing about it all is the absolute lack of a sense of humor. Like, the inability to laugh at oneself and go, actually, I am a bit ridiculous, you know. It is a bit ridiculous, you know, that there are all these sacred cows that you must not, blah, blah, you know, we know how it is here. But at the same time, America also breeds these amazing minds, and you never know who that person's going to be. And I'll give you an example. You know, I tell you, you know that I'm here at this vet hospital right now.
Yeah.
As I speak, we're trying to treat the eye of this horse that's got a mesquite thorn in his eye, one of our therapy horses. I'm standing outside the treatment room right now while they're figuring out what to do. And that horse is actually owned by my neighbor Stafford, who also owns Betsy, who is the horse that Rowan first established contact with. I don't own those two horses. I just look after them. But Stafford is a true blue Republican. And obviously I'm a pinko commie, tree-hugging, you know, liberal. But we enjoy each other, you know, and we drink together and we ride together and we are politically incorrect together and we get a kick out of each other's differences. I think that's the key. And you can't always find that, but you do actually find that in Texas quite a lot, that there are some shared things. Like, you know, we love this life. We love the countryside. We love the horses. We love the kids. We love the animals. We love that, you know. So we can tease each other a little bit, you know, and it's okay. And it's fun. And at the end of the day, we love each other. We're good neighbors, you know. And I look after his horses, and he lets me do all kinds of things. And it's a functional, it's back to tribe, isn't it? You know, you don't have to always share the same point of view. You can agree to differ, and you can have a beer. You know, and it's okay. So
but
Texas is a bit like that, too. Well, 8 or 10, yeah.
No,
why not open a pub? I think that's our next venture.
Oh my goodness! No, I experience the same kind of thing because I'm about as liberal as you can get. But I live in Tennessee, and was raised in Alabama, born in Mississippi, so I've seen the spectrum, as you would say. But
exactly.
You never can determine. It can be the most, like, I see people on tractors pulling hay and with the most southern accent you could think of, and they come out sometimes with the most brilliant stuff.
They
and
do.
I'm going, like, you just can't stereotype people. You can't assume
it's
Republican,
just, it's the human,
redneck
it's the human
is
heart.
Going to be
totally.
Racist.
You know, some of them are, some of them aren't. Yes, a
right.
lot of them are, because it's in the culture. The hell, they fought a war over it. But nonetheless, not everybody is. And it's the human heart. If you close your heart, you start to die, don't you? That's the thing. And you meet people like that sometimes, and they're like the Walking Dead.
Right.
And what's the point? What's the point of living your life on the planet like that? You don't have that long. In fact, I did actually die earlier this year. No exaggeration. I was jumping a horse over a big fence, and the horse hit the fence and flipped a somersault in midair, came down on top of me, and broke my leg in six places. And but that didn't kill me. What killed me was in the recovery room afterwards, they accidentally overdosed me on morphine. And I was down the tunnel talking to God, having a lovely time. And one of the things you realize in that situation is the only thing that matters is love. Everything else is, the only thing that matters is love. And so to spend one's time here, spending many moments closing one's heart,
right,
is to in fact be dead in life. And that's just sad. You know, there's nothing necessarily intrinsically wrong with it, but what a waste, eh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Man, that really, I mean, you've had so many perspectives in life that other people can't even imagine. And that in itself is what formed this whole journey as well. You've seen things that just the best of humans and the worst of humans, I would assume.
Yeah. No,
so,
you know, but what does seem true is that love always seems to conquer the whole lot. Love always prevails.
So what is your dream for your son?
For my son?
Yeah.
My dream is his dreams, whatever his dreams are. That
exactly.
I want to be in service to his dreams.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's the same thing with my daughter, is I want to support you in wherever your internal world tells you you need to go.
Totally. You just tell me what you need and I'll be there. That's all I need for my fulfillment.
Right. That is, and he seems that he's doing well, you said?
He's doing really well. Well, like you said, he's showing me. So he told me he wanted to do this TV show about endangered and dangerous animals. So we're doing it. We just got back from Romania filming.
He's communicating on a whole different level now?
Oh, yeah. He's like operating the camera and helping script out the show. And
really?
Yeah. No, he's amazing, doing amazingly well.
And what about socially? How is he?
He's great.
With those skills.
He's great. No, he's great. He's great. He's got friends he hangs out with. He cracks jokes. He loves life. He's charismatic, you know. And he's his quirky self, but he's very effective. I mean, hell, he's starting a TV series for crying out loud. He's only 10. It's not bad. I wasn't doing that, you know. Because he's not afflicted by the ego. That's the thing. He kind of gets on with the job at hand.
So tell us again about the different things of your foundation. I want to make sure that, is there anything else about your foundation that you wanted us to cover?
Well, just that we do work all over North America and now in lots of other places in the world with autism families, and we serve local families for free, and we subsidize places on these three-day autism camps, you know, horse boy camps with where we ride and live together in this sort of tribal way, and we see enormous changes. And So this is sort of a growing movement, and we would love people to be involved. We would love their support. We'd love their financial support so that when things happen, like this horse who just got injured, and I'm at the vet hospital and they present me with a bill for a grand, there's money in the pot to help with that, because that horse will go back and work for children. But, you know, really, I think if people are just curious and they want to just go and see what we do, we have two websites. We have one that's just the foundation, which is horseboyfoundation.org. horseboyfoundation.org, and that's got a big old pink donate button on it, as well as the information about the work we do. And then we have another one called horseboyworld.com, which we have a for-profit side too, where we train people to work with autistic kids and horses in the way that we have learned to do ourselves, and the money that we make from that subsidizes the foundation. So that's also an interesting thing for people to go onto and look at what we do, how we do. If people want to get trained in horseboy method, whether they're riders or whether they're not riders, doesn't matter. We do trainings here in Texas at our farm, the New Trails Center, but we also go all over America and all over Europe all the time, at least twice a month, giving trainings. And we do them on the web too, and so on. So if people are interested, just go to horseboyworld.com.
Wow. I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I hope you consider the show part of your family. For whatever you need,
I would love to
contact me. And
thank you. I will.
I would be more than willing to get any information you need out there on any subject. I'm pretty open to whatever the world brings.
Okay.
So definitely
then,
consider me a source, and let me know how the horse is coming, and I'll put that information out as well.
Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
And likewise. You know, anything you need from us, let us know.
Oh, great. And I will be contacting you to discuss. Can you tell everybody the name of your other book? Because you will be coming on later on and speaking on that as well.
I wrote another book a few years ago called The Healing Land. And that is about the time that I spent living with the Bushmen in southern Africa, and how I got drawn into their land rights struggle and their systems of shamanism, which, of course, is what resulted in Rowan meeting them and the Mongolia trip and the whole horseboy thing. And it goes into my quirky family in Africa, which is quite funny, and just all the crazy adventures that we had, as well as this extraordinary and complex spiritual and political world that we got drawn into, and that story there, which takes place in South Africa and Botswana. So, yes, it would be a great honor to be able to come and speak about that, too.
Absolutely. Now, is there any timeline for the completion of this next book, or is it just something you're starting to work on?
I've just started to work on it now, so 18 months, give me 18 months. And that the first edition should be coming out in about 18 months.
I'll definitely be watching for it and have you back on to hear that side of the story as well.
Thank you.
So I wish you and everybody that comes in contact with you good luck in dealing with this, and to the parents who are facing this, stay strong and keep fighting.
Yeah. And remember, it will be okay. It will truly be okay. If you're in that position, if you're in that place that we were in 5 years ago, it will be okay.
Is it get better as the child gets older?
It does if you really think about the environment that the child is in, and really do everything you can to optimize that environment for that child, then that child is going to really surprise you, yeah.
Oh, great.
If not, it's 50-50, you know, so. So the main thing for listeners who are in that position is this. Ask yourself, what are your own dreams? Because let's say if you had a dream, if you'd always really wanted to live by the ocean, or you'd always really wanted to live in the mountains, or you'd always really wanted to do that break for happiness, do it, and do it now. Because that's going to serve your child. And you don't need money to go live by the beach in Hawaii. There's plenty of people living by the beach in Hawaii who teach school, take out the trash, you know, do whatever job. It's not just a rich person's thing. If you want to change your environment, if there's a dream you want to follow, do it now. Follow it now, because that's going to be what serves your kid.
Wow. Keep on dreaming, and definitely keep us posted.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to know you now.
Likewise.
All right. You have a good night. And thank you, everyone,
you
for
too.
Listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So clean.